Good afternoon, ladies. We're studying today Perashat Toledot, most difficult Perashah. As we explained in previous classes, the whole Sefer Bereshit is difficult. Don't be fooled into thinking that because these are stories and because we teach it to our children in grade school, so this must be the easy Sefer. And the hard stuff is when you get to the mitzvot and the laws and the technicalities. I'm not discounting that. That's hard also. But don't underestimate the depth and the difficulty in trying to understand these perashot. Specifically, Perashat Toledot goes down as one of the hard ones. Bezat Hashem, today we'll just try to make some practical points. Firstly, the Pasuk writes, Ele Toledot Yitzhak ben Abraham. The Perashah is now going to move on to talk about Yitzhak, the son of Abraham. We finished with Abraham and Sarah last week. Now we move on to the second of the Avot, Yitzhak, the son of Abraham. But the Pasuk right away says, Abraham holidit Yitzhak. You have to know that it was Abraham that begat Yitzhak. As if to say, Abraham was his father. Of course, what do you have to tell me? You just told me, Ele Toledot Yitzhak ben Abraham. Yitzhak, the son of Abraham. Why repeat right after and tell me, and you should know it was Abraham that begat Yitzhak. Abraham was the father of Yitzhak. Abraham holidit Yitzhak. So there's a famous midrash that says there was some letzim. A letz is a scoffer. It's a wise guy. Call him in English a cynic. Somebody that always has a wise crack. Somebody that always has a dig, something sarcastic to say. So they had those guys around in Abraham's time and Yitzhak's time. They're called letzim. Everybody knows letz. So what were they saying? They were saying, Me'avimelech nit'abera Sarah. We know how Sarah became pregnant. It wasn't from Abraham. It was from Avimelech. We know the story. After all, didn't we learn last week Sarah was kidnapped? You know, who knows what went on behind closed doors? Coincidentally, right after she comes out of the palace, shortly thereafter, she's pregnant. So they came along and they started to talk with their cynicism, as if to say, it's not from Abraham, it's Avimelech's child. So what did God have to do in order to dispel those rumors? God made a miracle. The image of Yitzhak turned exactly like the image of his father. They were twins, practically. You looked at Abraham, you looked at Yitzhak, you saw spitting images. As we do many times, when you see a child, right away you're able to look at his features and say, oh, your mother must be, your father must be. But this was exact. So now all that talk went to the wayside. So Rav Chida asks a question. Rav Chida says, yeah, these guys are letzim, they're wise guys, but they're worse than letzim. They're reshaim. They're wicked people. You know, so why not call them what they really are? Why do you call them a letz when they're worse than a letz? These guys over here are now putting a question mark on the whole validity of Yitzhak, and they're claiming that Sarah did what she did with Avimelech. This is not a letz. This is the next level. This is a rasha. So the Chida comes and tells us the Chidush, which really tells us the nature of a letz. They were saying it was from Avimelech that Sarah gave birth. If you analyze what they were saying, they really weren't telling a lie. They were right. But you just have to understand it. As a result of Sarah being taken into captivity and Abraham praying for Avimelech, God answered Abraham to have a child. Because he prayed for Avimelech to have a child, as we learned last week. And as a result of that, God said, you're praying for somebody else and you need the same thing, I'll answer you. So who really was the cause of causing Sarah to give birth, Avi Melech. Yeah, but that's a litz. See, a litz is a wise guy where when you confront him and say, how did you say that? No, this is what I meant. But he says it in a way where people can misinterpret. And he wants them to misinterpret. So the litz is, he's double trouble, the litz. You know, he makes a statement that you can't really, he can't hold them accountable for. Because when you go to him and say, how dare you say that it was Avimelech that caused Sarah to give birth? What do you mean? Don't you know the story? Of course, Avimelech. Avram prayed for Avimelech, and as a result of that, if it wasn't for Avimelech, it doesn't happen. So we're good. We didn't have any sinister intentions. So that's a litz, where he's able to defend this thing, but he says it in public, where people walk away and don't understand it like that. And that's their intent from the beginning. You have to be very, very careful how you talk, especially that people should not misunderstand. Torah continues. So she was Yitzchak gets married to Rivka. Rivka gets pregnant. So it says that she was having a difficult time. The babies were wrestling in the womb. And the famous Midrash says that when she passed the synagogue, when she passed the yeshiva, she felt one of the kids trying to get out, as if she didn't want to go learn. And when she passed the church, and she passed the places of Avodah Zarah, she felt again the pangs, as if somebody wants to get out. So she says, what's going on over here? So she runs to the rabbis. It says she went to the yeshiva, the local yeshiva at the time, probably the only yeshiva at the time was Yeshivat Shem V'Aivir. They had an institution, they had a Torah institution. Don't ask me what they learned, but they had some type of curriculum. So she gets to the yeshiva, rabbis, you have to help me, the kicking, the yeshiva, the church. What do I do? Lamma ze anochi. So what do they tell her? They tell her, shene goyim bebetnech, listen, you have twins, and they're going to grow up to be great nations, and the older one is going to serve the younger one. Verav ya'avod sa'ir. And Rivka goes home very happy. And we don't understand why you're happy. Your whole problem was, you walk by a shul, you walk by a church. They come and tell you, Mabruk, you're having twins, and the older one's going to serve the young one, and she's good. What was bothering her, and how did they pacify her? So the famous thought that set over was, she didn't know she was having twins. They didn't have sonograms in those days. They didn't have all that x-rays and all that. So you assume you're having one. The problem was when she walked by the shul, it didn't bother. Yeah, the baby wants to get out. I have a tzaddik in my stomach. Fantastic. Look at that. It has such an urge that it's magnetized towards religion. Beautiful. But then when she walked by the Avodah Zarah, the same baby's kicking. She says, Shema Yisrael, the kid's schizophrenic. The kid over here has a split personality. Which you can deal with people that are at least one way. You know, if a guy's religious, fine. If you have another guy that's not, okay, at least everybody knows where they stand. You know, the Rasha, you hope one day you can bring him to your side. But fine, everybody's, at least you're loyal on a path. It's consistent. But you have a child that has a split personality, this is the most dangerous thing. In the morning he goes to Knees and he learns a little, and then in the afternoon he's gambling and he's doing all sorts of things. So Rivka says, "Dachirak lamba ze anochi." This is the type of child I'm going to have, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. You know, he's in both worlds. So when she goes to the rabbis, the rabbi says, "No. Shnei goyim bebitnech. You're having twins. Oh, I'm having twins. That's another story." So one guy's committed and one guy's not committed. I can deal with that. So she was pacified. That's a great lesson to us. I'm not going to... Of course, this is a topic where it allows any speaker to elaborate and talk for hours on the split personalities that we all have. Every one of us, including the speaker, you know, we'd love to say that we're all, straight bit midrash and all that without any other additives or preservatives, but it's not like that. All of us in a certain way are split personalities. You know, we like to come to class, we do the right thing, and then we also like to have our own personal enjoyments, whatever they might be. That's exactly what Rivka was scared of. You know, it's the Jew when he's living in both worlds. Specifically in our community, we see this phenomenon that people are able to dance in two parties simultaneously and live here and live there. Rav Kaa held that that's not the healthiest thing. Of course, you know, it's better than being a Rasha, probably. It's better than being totally on the other way, only because there's a chance that you might end up being totally committed. But if living in both worlds, if the person thinks that that's ideal, if the person thinks this is the way you're supposed to live, I get along with this one, I get along with that one, I'm good. I have a little of my yitzhara, a little of my yitzhara. If you feel at least that there's room to grow, you're fine, by the way. The person that lives in both worlds and says, you know, it's not the ultimate. This is not the way I'm supposed to be, but this is where I'm holding, and God willing, you know, I'll get more to the right way, you're fine. But if that becomes a philosophy, if that becomes your way of life, where you say, this is why I do it. I do here, I do this, and this is it. This is, I've reached my perfection. If schizophrenia becomes normal, then where do you have a problem? But if schizophrenia, you understand that we have issues, then it's not so, then it's not so bad. So that's what Ifka was concerned. Another rabbi says, after the rabbi spoke to Ifka, the pains went away. How? Because the words of the rabbis were, the older one is going to serve the younger one. So now, once they heard that, nobody wanted to be the older one anymore. Because the older one gets the raw deal. So they stopped, no one wants to come out now. Everybody said, you go first. I'm not. Till then, they're begging to get out. Once they heard the older one, so therefore, it helped them not only satisfy our conscience, but it also was able to satisfy the birth pains. Hatam Sofer has a nice thought. He asks, tradition tells us that when the baby's in the womb, there's an angel that comes and teaches that baby the Torah. The tradition also says that when the baby comes out, that same angel taps the child right under the nose, above the lip, and puts like an imprint of a fingerprint, which everybody has, or most people have, and that is like a delete button. Once the baby gets zapped by that angel, so all the Torah that was studied in the womb is forgotten. There were cases in history where children were born without it, without the dot. And they were brilliant children. You know, 2 years old already, they were quoting Gemariot, and they knew the answers to every question, and it was an unbelievable thing to read about. I once saw a child in Toronto that was born without it. The baby was in a serious condition, and when I walked into the hospital to visit the child, the parents were beside themselves. It was a little baby, there was on machines, of course, and stuff, but I consoled the parents who had no idea. I said, I never saw this. Look at the cleft. You don't see any marking. They said, Rabbi, we noticed that. What does that mean? I said, this child over here is a holy soul. And now you know why this is happening. Because such a child cannot exist in such a world. And in the end, the child passed away. But the parents at least were consoled to know that they were the recipients of bringing down such a holy neshama that had in its mind. I told the parents, you see this baby on machines is smarter than all of us. It knows more than all of us. It just can't express itself in the way it is. Now that being said, the Hatam Sofer, that's why you have to be very careful, specifically the ladies, in situations where doctors want to induce labor. You know, the rabbis are not so fond of such a situation, only because, you know, the angel's teaching the child. And induction, you're speeding up a process, so you're taking away maybe from some of the spiritual levels that child can reach. Now, I'm not saying this as a rule. Don't panic. There's no rules here. Of course, if the doctor feels it's for the health of the child and the health of the mother, we're not talking about that case. But, you know, you have to be very careful and not intimidated by doctors, because a lot of times they say, you know, we'll induce you on Friday because he doesn't want to ruin his Sunday golf game, you know, the tea time. He's going surfing on Sunday afternoon, so therefore let's do it on Friday. Let's finish it so I don't have to be bothered over Saturday and Sunday because he wants to go on vacation. Now, that type of induction is not legal. Doesn't make sense, such an induction. But of course, if it's the purpose of health, there's no question. You call your local rabbi. Now, after you know this introduction, he asks, why does Yaakov, when he sees the Beit Midrash, he's kicking to go out? You have it better. You're learning with an angel. There's an angel teaching you Torah in the womb. You're not going to get better Torah in a mitzvah. Now you have the best learning partner. You have the best rabbi. So where are you running? So the Hatam Sofer said, yes, it's great to learn with an angel. But if you have to live in the same womb with Esav, it's worth it to give up learning with an angel and get out and learn by yourself. For me, the Hatam Sofer teaches us the damage of bad friends or being in a bad environment. He says, usually, the rule is, bad influences good before good will influence bad. You know, the rationale to say, you know, I can have a bad friend and God willing, you know, I'll turn him around. Usually, it doesn't work that way. You know, they'll affect you with their bad traits before you're going to affect them. So therefore, Yaakov says, you're right, I'm giving up a lot here. I'm learning with a malach, but you know what? If I have to learn on the same table next to this Rasha Esav over here, it's not worth it. Who knows if some of his traits will wear off on me. That's very hard to change. So that tells us about the attitudes. Torah says, "Vayehav Yitzhak et Esav." Yitzhak loved Esav. Kisayid b'fiv. Remember, Esav used to be a hunter. Esav used to go hunting. His father Yitzhak used to like the venison and whatever it was, the game, and he used to give it to his father. VeYaakov Rivka ohevet et Yaakov. But Rivka loves Yaakov. So we see there's a thing. Yitzhak is favoring, let's say, Esav, and Rivka is favoring Yaakov. The Malbim says over here a most important concept. If you look at the Pasuk, there's a grammatical inconsistency. When it comes to the love that Yitzhak has for Esav, it's written in past tense, by Ye'ehav. Yitzhak loved his son. It's past. When it comes to the love of Rivka to her son Yaakov, it says V'Rivka ohevet. It's present tense. She loves. Yitzhak loved. Rivka loves. Why? What does it mean? So he says unbelievable. He talks about two types of love in the world. Love that's dependent on a reason and an unconditional love. Because most people in the world do not have ideal love. They love other people for what they can get out of them. For example, if you'd ask a child when he's young, what do you want to be when you grow up? Most of them will say a doctor, a lawyer, a teacher, this or that. They never answer the question. The question was not what do you want to do when you grow up. It's what do you want to be. You want to be a doctor? That's your profession. But in this world, we confuse. We look at people not on based on what they are, but on what they do. That's the way we define people. If a person's a doctor, we don't know if he's honest. We don't know if he, God forbid, is a bad father or a bad husband. That doesn't matter to us. Person has money? Person successful, already he receives our honor. We respect people today, not for what they are, unfortunately, but for what they do. Now, as long as they're able to do what they do, they have honor, they have love. But once they lose their money, so that's it, there goes the love also. Because we never love the person for what he is. We loved him because he had money, and now he doesn't have any money anymore, so he's worthless already. So when you love people for what they do, that love is fleeting. That love is temporary. But when you love somebody for what he is, he's honest, he's upstanding, he's decent, he's generous, those are traits of a person. When you love a person for what he is, that love is forever. It's not dependent on anything. Teach this to your children, ladies, when they start to date, to make sure that they're not marrying for ulterior motives, because things change. If you marry for a purpose because of, you know, good looks, something that's important, but good looks can change. It's not the only thing you're looking for. Money, money, we see what happens in the world. People are up one day and they go down. If God forbid that was the whole love was based on things, when those things are not there, God forbid the marriage becomes destroyed. So the Pasuk's telling us over here. Vayehav Yitzhak et Esav. You know why Yitzhak loves Esav? For what he does. Kitzayit b'fiv. Because he's a hunter and he gives him game. He gives him venison. He gives him food. But what happens when Esav's going to become an old man? And he can't hold the bow and arrow anymore. And he lost his aim. And he can't do what he does. Vayehav. So that love is in the past tense. That love is fleeting. That love goes away. Because it's the love that's based on what he does. V'Rivka ohevet et Yaakov. Rivka loves Yaakov. Why? Not because of because he's Yaakov. Not for what he does. Because of his essence. Because of his being. Because he's Yaakov. That type of love is in the present. That type of love does not dissipate in the course of time. It's ohevet. It's in the present and going forward. A great lesson and priority in life. There was one columnist that wrote, and this is a goy, it bothered him when he would go to cocktail parties. And people would, you know, have a drink in their hand and start talking to each other. He says, inevitably, within the first 2 minutes of the conversation, the question comes up, what do you do? And based on the answer, you see the admiration and the respect of the people in the conversation. If you answer that you have a, you're a businessman on Fifth Avenue, everybody look at you with different eyes already. They want to get closer to you. That's the question. Is it bothering him? Because what does that have to do with anything? So he used to have, he got so frustrated, he used to have a patent answer. When people would come to him and say, what do? He would tell them, I'm an undercover agent for the IRS. He says, yeah, and the conversation ended very quickly after that. Everybody, goodbye, nice to meet you, and see you later. They ran away. He says, that's the unfortunate part of our generation. People are not respected anymore for what they are. But only if they if the things that they have and what they do. But that's a bad way of people that have friends like that. The friends are really not worth too much. It's ulterior motives. They tell a story just to bring out the point. The the senator, the former senator of New Jersey, Bill Bradley. He was at a dinner, the Democratic National Convention. All the big wigs are at the dinner, and he's there also. So they're serving dinner, and they come to the senator, and they serve him a potato, a baked potato, with a piece of butter on top. So Senator Bradley turns to the waiter and says, I'd like another piece of butter. So the waiter says, you can't have. He said, I can't have. Do you know who I am? I'm the Honorable Senator Bill Bradley from New Jersey. I'm a former NBA All-Star. I'm a Rhodes Scholar. I sit on the Committee of Finance and Military and Taxation, and I gives him his whole thing. I demand another piece of butter. So the waiter turns to him and says, do you know who I am? So the senator's taken aback. He says, no, who are you? He says, I'm in charge of the butter. People want respect not for who they are, but for what they do. Hence, v'yehav Yitzhak et Esav kisay b'fiv v'rivka ohevet et Yaakov. Torah tells us, Yaakov Avinu was making a soup. Rabbis tell us he was making lentil soup, ades soup. Chachamim tell us why he was making ades, because his grandfather had passed away. It seems that they had the same custom that we still have until today, that God forbid during the Avelut, it's customary to serve the mourners exactly, round foods, like a lentil which is round, eggs that are round, in order to console the mourner by saying You know, life is a cycle. You know, people are born and people die. And this is the way it goes. Don't think that your situation that happened is an exception and that, you know, God's picking on you. That's the way it goes. People are born and people die, and it's cyclical. It just happens over and over again. And then it's going to happen, unfortunately, to everybody. We should all live to 120. But when they see that that's the nature of the world, so that it consoles them as if God's not picking on you. You know, you're not on any bad list. This is the way the world happens. So Lentil's around. So Abraham had passed away. So he was making for his father. Yitzhak sitting. So he has to make for his father. In the middle of that soup, he's making the soup. Esav comes from the field and he's tired. So the Torah tells us, Esav turns to his brother and says, "Hal'iteni na min ha'adom ha'adom hazeh." I get you the right word. That's the right word he has there. Pour into me. Hal'iteni. It's a very, it's like an animal. He doesn't even want to put it in a bowl with a spoon. You just open my mouth. I'll open my mouth. Like put a stick over there like you do on the hood of your car to keep it open. And you'll just pour the soup into my mouth. Hal'iteni na min ha'adom ha'adom hazeh. Give me some of this red stuff. He doesn't even call it soup. Give me some of this red stuff. Ki ayef anochi, because I'm dead tired. Al ken kara shemo Edom. And that's why for history, till today, we call Esav, the nation of Esav, Edom, the red nation. It's a strong question here. Yeah, because once, when he came home from work and he was exhausted, so instead of calling it Ades, he calls it the red stuff. So that's it. We're changing his name forever. Now we're going to call him the red man, the red stuff man. Wait, it's a slip of the tongue. Okay, you said it. Well, why does his name now become forever and ever based on this one story where he called the soup red stuff? Well, my first question is, that's not why he was called red. He's called red because he called the others red.
He's
okay, ladies, relax. Everything will be good. We'll answer all your questions. What I don't understand is, when you make lentil soup, it's not red. It turns yellow, turns brown, green, every other color, but it's not red. So what type of recipe was Yaakov using over here that he ended up with red lentils? That's another question. Red lentils, there you go, simple answer. But the rabbis say something else. Esav says, Hal'iteni na. Now, na, the word na, in most places means please. Very good, you're right. Hal'iteni na, in most places means please, please give me. Now, we know Esav doesn't use the word please. That's not his language. Esav is a very, he's not the most courteous, put it that way. You know? So now he's coming home from work exhausted. He can't even call the soup. He's calling it red stuff. But he had enough for time to say please. If he's not calling it soup, trust me, he's not saying please either. So the Mefarshim explain that we see another place in the Torah, the word na, by Korban Pesach. The Torah says when it comes to eating the Korban Pesach, you can't eat it na. Don't eat it na. Na also means raw. Like in Arabic, they say kibbeh neyeh. Neyeh is raw. It's raw. It's not cooked. So therefore, what Esav was saying was, hal'iteni nah. He wasn't finished cooking it yet even. So before you finish cooking it, it's still red. You know, it doesn't turn colors till the end. So you see what type of animal Esav was over here. You know, it's hal'iteni nah. Give it to me now. I'm not finished yet. Don't worry. Give it to me raw. Just pour it down my throat. But we're back to the question. For this one time, why does Esav have the name Edom? So the Mefarshim explained like this. Yaakov right away tells him, okay, you want some soup? I'll give you the soup. But Mechra Kayom. Sell me like today your birthright. Yes, this Yaakov says this is an opportunity. He wants something from me, I also want something from him. The birthright, which was in the hands of Esav, allowed Esav to inherit all the blessings, allows him to bring korbanot. It's like you're the kohen. Whatever spiritual responsibilities are going to fall in the family, Esav is the one that's going to do them. Now Yaakov knows who his brother is. He says, I can't let my brother do this over here. He's going to destroy the whole thing. So he says, you want soup? All right, so good. I'll give you the soup. You give me the birthright. And Shalom Yisrael. But he uses a word. He says, Mechra Kayom. Sell me like the day. What do you mean, sell me like the day? Just Mechra Hayom. Sell me today. What do you mean, like the day? So the Sephorno says like this. Yaakov saw something about Esav that he said, this man over here cannot be the spiritual heir of my father. He cannot inherit all this spirituality. You know why? The devotion that Esav had to his work. Esav was obsessed with his work. You might call him, you know, the first alcoholic. Or workaholic. He was an alcoholic also. A workaholic. All he did is work, work, work. So much so that when he comes home from the office, he can't even see soup anymore. He's so obsessed with his career. He's so obsessed with what he's doing. So he can't even see the world and what the world is anymore. Give me red stuff. By saying that word red stuff, that was an indication on Esav's priorities. Esav lives for the moment. To make his money. To him, life is short, and therefore he has to amass as much as he can. So he lives for the moment. He has no interest in the future. Nothing else matters. So Yaakov says, Mechra Kayom. To you, the only thing that's important is today. And that's why I need the Bechora from you. The Bechora is spiritual. People that are spiritual don't worry about today. They're worried about the future, Olam Haba, eternity, the next world. If you can come home and you can't even call soup soup, that means you're so into your work. You're so engulfed. You're so bogged down by living for today. And you're so exhausted from what you're doing in your career that you can't even call soup soup. That means you're lost in this world. You're living for today. You're not living for the future, for Olam Abba. Therefore, sell me like today. Because today is so important to you. We see the exact opposite. At the end of the Perasha, the attitude. There's a lesson for people that have careers and work and do. Of course, you have to go to work. You have to support yourself. You have to make money. You have to live. We don't say no. But when the career becomes everything. You know, but when work becomes more important than family. When work becomes more important than religion, when work becomes more important than a lot of other priorities in life, then you have to reevaluate and say, hold it, hold it, hold it. There's more important things in life than just going to work and making money. There's other priorities. And before it's too late, you have to readjust what's important in life. Esav lives for the moment. Therefore, Yaakov Avinu says, a man that lives for the temporary cannot be involved in the future of Yisrael with spirituality. But there's one thing that Esav did have. Esav respected his father like nobody respected his father. It's one thing you have to give him credit for. Kibud av v'em. As a matter of fact, the Gemara writes, Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel once commented, he says, all my life I respected my parents, my father, but I didn't even reach 100th of the level of Esav. And he explains why. He says, when Esav used to serve his father, he used to put on a special garment. You know, a special tuxedo. When he go in to serve his father, he changed from his regular work clothes, put on a new suit, a starched shirt, a tie, walk in. But when I serve my father, and I serve my father, I don't change my clothes. I wear the same clothes. And I cooked him lunch. I come in with the same clothes, the dirty work clothes. So he says, I didn't even reach 100. Look at Esav, you know, such a respect. And the question is obvious on this Gemara. All right, Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel, I have an answer for you. The next time you serve your father, put on a tuxedo. Instead of bemoaning, oh, he's unbelievable, he puts on a tuxedo, I don't do that. Oh, okay, do it. Do it, and then that's it. Then you're like Esav. If that's the whole thing,
It's attainable. You know, you go buy a tuxedo and put it on. That's it. Finished. You reach their sav level. The answer is Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel knew that he could buy a tuxedo and put it on. What he was bemoaning was the attitude. He said, Esav, when he put on the tuxedo, he understood that this is the prophet. He knew what his father was, which means he felt it. It wasn't a hollow act. When he put on a tuxedo, he understood, I'm standing in front of the king. My father's a king, and therefore it's befitting for me to dress like such a suit. Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel was bemoaning his attitude. He said, yeah, I could put on a suit and go to, but I don't feel it. So therefore, that's to the people, they might be impressed. Oh, look at Rabban Shimon. But I know myself, who am I kidding? I don't have that feeling about my father, he's a king, that should bring me to do such a thing like that. And if I do it, I'm fooling people. I'm fooling myself. I'm not holding on that level to appreciate what my father is like, Esav. That's a very important lesson. Because this we can apply to a lot of situations in religion. I'll just give you one. The Gemara Yoma says that there was a lady called Kimhit. Kimhit was a great lady. So great that the Gemara writes, 7 of her sons all became Kohanim Gedolim. They all became high priests. Now, if you have 1 out of 7, you're doing okay. But to go 7 for 7, they all became the holiest man of Israel, Yom Kippur, he goes into the Holy of Holies. So they asked Kimhit. You know, she's the ultimate mother. Look what she raised. So they said, you know, what did you do? What did you do to bring 7 Kohanim like this into the world? So she says, my whole life, I was so modest, and I would cover my hair all times, that the ceilings of my house never saw even a braid of my uncovered hair. That's how modest she was. Now, to think about it, it's not so easy. In the shower, and sleeping, and it doesn't matter. She had a system. She never, modesty on the highest level. It was the merit of the tzniut that brought me these children. Okay, it's beautiful. So one rabbi asked, okay, if that's the secret in bringing good children into the world, so that's it. Everybody go cover their hair now to that extreme. And you know, everybody's looking to have good children. And people have tried it, and it didn't work. So you say, what are you talking about? I thought that was it. Was she lying? Was she sketching? She wasn't sketching. When she said it, she meant it. So how come when people did the exact same thing, they didn't bring 7 Kohanim into the world? They didn't even bring 7 close to Kohanim in the world. That 7 mediocre or less than mediocre children. What happened? The explanation is, you forgive me, ladies, but it wasn't merely covering their hair that did it. That wasn't it. Covering the hair may be a hollow act if it's not done with the reasoning. She covered her hair in modesty because she understood God is in this house and God is close to her and God is watching her. Therefore, out of respect of God, she acted in the most modest way. So you know what really brought her those children? Fear of God. It just manifested itself in modesty. Now the modesty that she had was an indication that she understood God is in the house watching her at all times. So therefore, if you know there's a video camera on you at all times, so you can act in a certain way. You know, you're not going to do things that people are watching. God's watching. So you know, you're married, you cover, you do, you don't want to reveal yourself. But the other ladies that were just dressing modestly, but they don't know why they were dressing modestly. They were dressing because that became the style, or that became the fashion, or that became the it wasn't because of what God wants. It was just an outward dress code. So that's nice. I mean, it might be the beginning of something nice, but it's not going to bring 7 children Kohanim Gedolim. It's the same thing that the Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel was saying. I could also put on a suit and go respect my father, but that's not me. I don't believe it yet. I'm not on that level. So therefore, God bless our modest ladies. God bless all our ladies. They're all modest. But you have to know, ladies, modesty is not a dress code. It's just not putting on a skirt or covering here, which is a halakha. I'm not saying no. I wouldn't tell you something that my own family doesn't do. But that being said, there's a rationale behind it. It's because there's God in the world, and we're standing in His presence, and we have to be dignified in His presence, and it's not... So it's supposed to lead you to a higher level. But when, God forbid, modesty turns into the wrong things, and it turns into showing off, and it turns into arrogance, and it turns into competition, it turns into exactly what modesty wasn't supposed to be, so then indeed, it is a hollow act. Baruch Hashem, we're not talking to our ladies. Our ladies that have committed to such modest codes only come after learning about it, understanding its importance. But unfortunately, like everything in life, sometimes we get caught up in the externals. We get caught up in the chitzoniyut, and in the outward appearance. That becomes the main thing, but the reason behind it, sometimes we forget. That's the lesson of kemchit. I'll just say one more idea. The Torah tells us that Yitzhak went with his wife to the city of Gerar. It's deja vu. That's where Abraham and Sarah went. And you have Avimelech over there, the king. And it says, Avimelech looked out of his window, and he saw Rivka and Yitzhak together. That's what I use the word mistachek. We might call that intimate, whatever you want to say it, but he saw it. It always bothered us. Yitzhak and Rivka are modest people. How's it possible? I mean, Avimelech, when he looks out of his window, he's able to see, maybe you didn't close the shade, you don't close the window. I mean, what? Modesty, what happened over here? How's it possible that the pervert Avimelech is able to penetrate what's going on in your privacy of your own home? How's that possible? How is Avimelech able to see what he saw? And the answer is, Chas v'shalom, Yitzhak and Rivka were modest. And they had the windows closed, and the shades drawn, and everything like that. The Gaon de Vilna tells a story once, how there was a man that came to Vilna, and the man knew everything about everybody in the town. He was able to tell you what you were doing behind closed doors. He was able to tell you exactly where you were, what you did. And the people were scared of this guy. This guy's going to go start now talking in front of everybody. All everybody's secrets are going to be out in the open. So they brought him to the Gaon de Vilna. And he tells the Gaon, you know, last week on this night you sat in this chair, and Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai was sitting to your right, and the Arizal was sitting to your left. These are rabbis that lived thousands of years before the Gaon de Vilna. They came down to learn with him. And you wrote in your book this and this chidush on this perasha, and you said that the Gaon de Vilna was unbelievable. It's exactly that. But he then told the guy, get out of my house, you're a rasha, I don't want to see you. So the student says, what do you mean, Rabbi? He's not a faker. He's telling you things that are accurate. He says, let me tell you something. There's two ways you can do that. One way is if you become so holy and you elevate yourself to the level where God will give you vision, where you're able to see from one side of the world to the other side, where you're able to see everything. When you attach yourself to holiness, God gives you His vision. Like the story is told of one of the Mekubalim, it might be Baba Sali even, where there was a girl that was missing. So they went to the great rabbi, a girl from London. And they said, Hakam, she's missing for such and such a time, and this and that, and what do we do? So he took out a piece of paper, and he started to draw a street, and he drew houses and homes and buildings. He said, does this look familiar? He said, Rabbi, it's exactly the configuration of one of the streets in London. Yeah, and the corner there, there's a monastery. Oh, yeah, yeah, she's in the monastery. Sure enough, they went, and they found in the basement of the monastery. Now, the Baba Sali wasn't in London. He definitely wouldn't have, the maps of London based on the knowledge that he was there. But he was so close to God that you're able to have a vision of the whole entire world from your own, from your desk in the Tibot. He said, but there's another way. The other way to get this vision is by the sides of Tum'ah, exactly. You go sleep in the cemetery, you bring on the Tum'ah of the Metim on you, and you do all sorts of bad things, immoral things, where the Tum'ah now becomes part of you. So now, you know, you become partners with the devil, so to speak, and now you get some of the powers from the bad. There's a good side, there's a bad side. See, this guy, he's able to see through walls, not because he's a tzaddik. He became partners with the Sitra Hara, with the powers of evil, and they're giving him that type of, call it black magic, maybe. You know, Paro was able to make a lot of magic. He wasn't a good guy. But, you know, when Moshe throws the stick and Paro throws the stick, they turn into snakes. And Paro makes blood like Moshe makes blood. So how? And Moshe is learning all day long, and Paro's a bum. The answer is, you know, Paro is using black magic and all that other stuff that's able to do that. So that's the answer with Avimelech. Avimelech was such a pervert and such a contaminated individual and such a lowlife and such a man that was involved in the Tum'ah and the most devilish things. It wasn't Yitzhak's fault. He closed the window, there was a concrete wall, shade. But it says he looked into the window and saw, that means it wasn't a lack of modesty on Yitzhak and Rivka's part. It was a lack of modesty or lack of decency on Avimelech's part, that he was using black magic to do all these things. Let this be a lesson to us. It's hard to control ourselves. It's hard to save ourselves from the black magic, the sorceress. But from the regular people, people have to be modest in front of other people. Whether it's in our lifestyle, it means the lesson might be not everybody has to know everything you're doing at all times. Yeah, that's modesty. Modesty is not only a dress. Modesty means divulging information. You know, telling everybody all the things you did and private things and all that. A modest person also is modest in his information. You know, they don't divulge every personal, intimate, private story to people. There's certain things that they're able to keep under their hat. They're able to keep a secret. You know, somebody that divulges a secret is also not modest. You can have 3 wigs on and 10 skirts on, but if you divulge a secret, so you know you're not modest because you're divulging information. You're not private. It's a lifestyle, we're saying over here. So Yitzhak and Rivka lived a modest lifestyle, no question about it. So they can't control Avimelech, but everything else is supposed to be controlled to our greatest capacity. Okay. Baruch Adonai Olam. Amen. Amen.